Radio Influence. Podcasting redefined.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to a very exciting Friday edition of the Dark to Light podcast with...
Thank God it's Friday, Frank. And...
Frank.
One syllable, gets to the point, Frank. Perfect name. It's Frank. Just the perfect name.
My dad's name.
Your father's name is Frank?
Yes.
How the hell have I not known that until now?
I don't know. But we did at the Legion one time, like an Iron Chef thing. And we were Team Frank and Beans.
Oh, well, see, you know what's funny? I have an old shirt. I actually have an old Frank and Beans shirt. I got it from, I don't know. This is from years ago. And I found it in there's a plastic Rubbermaid container down here in the basement that I guess has just like 50 pounds worth of shirts that I probably said, you know, I'm going to put these away for the season. And I forgot about them for years. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring them upstairs and switch out the shirts because there's so much stuff I haven't worn in years now. I'm going to do.
Put the Frank and Beans shirt on.
Yeah, one of them. Yep.
Put them on. So we just finished an interview with Kash Patel. A wide-ranging interview.
Tremendous.
It went everywhere, literally. He shared a lot of thoughts about Rod Rosenstein, none of them very good.
Everything said, I had especially on Rod Rosenstein's character. You just the way that he took questions in committee hearings and stuff like that. You know that he was just a greasy, greasy. Blah. Can't stand it. You can always tell by the way somebody styles their hair.
What hair?
Just that weird, I don't
waxy.
Know. Waxy Lego man hair.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, we're going to let this interview go on here. Fantastic interview with Kash. A lot of information in here, a lot of clarification, some brand new exclusives. Don't miss it, and we will come back at the end. Well, good morning, everyone, or good afternoon. And we are so honored to be joined today by Kash Patel, who is, I keep on saying, one of the only good things, I think, to come out of the entire Spygate debacle, because we learned that there are people out there still with integrity doing the work of the American people. So thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thanks, Tracy. I appreciate you guys having me, and it's great to be with the friendly Strong Island crew.
Yes. Well, outside of him.
Outside of me. You know, the upstater.
The northern man. We're north of the wall.
When I started reading about you, because you were, well, let's just go through this really quickly. You've done quite a bit, and I don't know that everybody out there knows what you've done. Chief of Staff to the Department of Defense. You also obviously worked with Rick Grenell at DNI. You were responsible for the Presidential Daily Brief. You were one of the highest ranking officials at the DOD, ODNI, and the White House. I mean, this is quite an impressive bio. And at the National Security Council, I mean, that's a lot.
Well, you know, I was fortunate to work for the greatest president of all time in President Trump. So we kind of, you know, a couple of guys from Queens got along.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yes. And, you know, where were you when Devin Nunes, said, okay, we need you to come over and help us with this investigation at the HPSI.
I was coming out of I was a terrorism prosecutor at DOJ during the Obama administration, and I did a stint at JSOC as a civilian doing global targeting operations with like SEAL Team 6 and Delta. So I came out of that, and I was just like, I don't want to be in DOJ anymore. And I was trying to go to the White House, to be honest with you. And I basically told Devin, there's no way I'm going to Congress to work on the Hill.
You did a stint. What made you hate the DOJ so much? That's my first question.
The lack of internal accountability infuriated me. I mean, it was awesome to work on, you know, I did the World Cup bombings. I was the lead for Maine Justice for Benghazi, but stuff like, you know, and during that is when we covered the Hillary Clinton email debacle and just the lack of internal accountability for people within DOJ covering up mistakes, and not a lot of them. I'm talking like five people. And I just said, you know what, if we're going to prosecute criminals and put them in prison, then who the hell is going to police us? And they basically were like, well, no one.
Wow. I didn't know you worked on Benghazi. That's interesting.
Yeah, 2 years.
We could do a whole show on just Benghazi.
Anytime you want. I'm happy to go.
Boy, so much started with that. I mean, that time, that was the beginning of the email scandal, everything.
Yeah, no, I remember it. I was at Maine Justice and National Security Division, so I wasn't at the U.S. Attorney's Office, thankfully, trying this case. I was like the lead prosecutor for HQ.
So can we talk a little bit about, this may seem out of order, but I'm interested now that I know all of this. Can we talk about what happened with Loretta Lynch and the New York field office of the FBI in regards to threatening the prosecutors there in the Eric Garner case in order to keep them from leaking the Hillary Clinton issues that were ongoing?
I'm not too familiar with the Eric Garner portion of it, or, you know, what Loretta Lynch was doing up with up there at EDNY when she was up there. And when she became AG.
She was AG at the time.
She was AG, that's right. Yeah, I was basically spending most of my time at JSOC then, and a little bit of my time at DOJ. So not too familiar with the Eric Garner issue, other than what I've read, which is not helpful.
Well, I'm going to have to fill you in on that because it's in the McCabe IG report that came out about his leaks to the Wall Street Journal. And that story that I covered got like 50,000 retweets. It went crazy. So I'll send you over that, the remnants of it. But, you know, all of this corruption like weaves itself everywhere. So going into the Spygate stuff that you did, you had the background of the Hillary Clinton email investigation. What was that like? What'd you do there?
Well, so I just touched upon it. So we came across massive discovery obligations when we were trying to do the Benghazi prosecution and get the right guys in. And it's a whole different story how the Benghazi prosecution was an ideal way to screw up a righteous prosecution by politicizing it, which is what Eric Holder did. But that's a different story. So when you're going through like billions of pages of discovery, you got to go in there and do your job and make sure you disclose what you need to disclose. And part of that was naturally emails that came across the servers at the State Department. Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. So we came across some emails that were just like, you know, kind of like, what does this have to do with anything? And why are they writing these emails? And we said, we thought, you know, at the time they were classified, and I think they still might be the content of them. But that sort of spun up, I think, the Hillary Clinton email investigation, which I did not work on directly. That was assigned to a select few people at DOJ. And they sort of spun that off and took that on separately. But it just right away, when I saw one of those emails, I was like, this isn't kosher. And someone should probably be looking at her emails.
So leading to the classification thing, we learned during the Mueller investigation that James Comey just classified and declassified at will in order to hide things. Is this a common occurrence at DOJ that they'll just classify nonsense because they don't want anyone to see it?
Well, one of the biggest problems that I learned during my tenure, be it at DOJ or in the intelligence community or DOD, is the overclassification of way too much material. I mean, don't get me wrong. There is a absolute need for classified materials and information and channels and communications. It serves a tremendous purpose and it allows us to do the bulk of our work. But the one thing, and I was a public defender when I started my career, so that's when I was taking on DOJ and going at them for Brady violations and hiding exculpatory evidence and things like that. So I sort of just had this second nature desire to disclose everything that should be disclosed to the public, the court, or whatever thing I was working on. And so I just thought that the Department of Justice at times did not do a good job, and I caught them doing it, disclosing information they should have. Now, there's original classification authorities like cabinet secretaries, like an FBI director, like an attorney general, and others in government who can classify and declassify at will. Most people in government don't have that ability to do that. But a lot of times I found that these higher ups were doing it to cover up things that would cause them embarrassment. And as you pointed out, James Comey and Andy McCabe are like the two biggest examples. Mm.
So,
you know, I'd like to jump in on that right real quick, because I read Cash on Real Clear Investigation. They were covering you and declassification and all that stuff. And they said that you didn't seem to have any indication that there was any game-changing smoking gun being kept from the public about Trump Russia. Now, from that standpoint, I don't know how much I put on into that, and because so much that we has been revealed to us, I don't know how many more guns and how much more smoke we would have needed to see that this was something going on here. But as far as game-changing smoking gun that maybe even the media could never have spun or treaded water on, is there stuff like that still out there that was not dumped onto the table?
I mean, I think you're referring to the RCP article that Aaron Maté did. And in terms of like what's left, I mean, we were able to get a lot out, but it took us like 3 years.
Yeah.
In terms of what's left, and remember, President Trump issued this big declassification order on his last day in office, which was basically a list of things that I had long recommended be declassified. The problem is I still haven't seen that list. So if he included everything I wanted in there, then there's no major game-changing material left if it's in that declassification order. And that's why I said that, because I haven't seen it and I don't know what's in it. And it's sort of slowly coming out every couple of weeks. John Solomon's doing some reporting on it.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen the content of it.
So in terms, when the special counsel started, you had to kind of stop doing what you guys were doing, because also Congress changed hands. So we had a switch in power there. And one of the things, we'll start here, because I know Aaron had a conversation with you about this. One of the things that was really outside of the norm was the media came at you hard.
Yeah, real hard.
They said really nasty things about you because you were doing such a good job. And you and Devin, the whole team, got really lambasted by the press, which you can't even really call them that anymore. And what was interesting to me, did it make you angry when you saw what Adam Schiff did during impeachment in supporting his staff that were being also attacked by Honest Media?
Well, as you guys well know, Adam Schiff's the biggest joke to hit Congress in United States history. So it's hard to get mad at a guy who has googly eyes for himself and not the truth. But in terms of like my experience with the media, you know, that actually started at DOJ. I was prosecuting these guys who were going to blow up these terrorists who were going to blow up the shopping malls in Houston, and basically had them arrested after 2 years, and the case was well on its way. And I was overseas working on some stuff for the military and got called back into the Texas courtroom by this lunatic judge. And I flew from Dushanbe, Tajikistan, straight to Houston. And of course, I didn't have a tie on me. So I went into his chambers without a tie. And you can look this up. It's all out there now, the transcript. And the guy ripped into me for being a Washington lawyer. And basically saying, why are you prosecuting this guy and leak it? He was starting to talk about classified information. It got really bad. I just shut up and said, hey, man, the mission matters more. If you want to yell at me, that's fine. And then he kicked me out.
Wow.
And the media, basically, the only thing they focused on was not that I was a Obama administration terrorism prosecutor prosecuting terrorists, preventing him from blowing up a shopping mall, but that I didn't have a tie and that this judge was in the right because he was yelling at me. And I asked Sally Yates, who was then the acting attorney general, to step in on behalf of one of her line prosecutors, and the Department of Justice totally failed to do anything. They didn't see it appropriate to back the play of their prosecutors. So I had that experience on top of 8 years of being a public defender. So when the media came after me again during Russiagate, I was like, yeah, this is pretty nasty stuff. But I was like, you know what? I've heard a lot worse from much better. So let's just keep doing the job.
That's awesome. I want to get into that whole investigation, because we had Lee Smith on the show. We had Congressman Nunes on the show. We talked about Spygate for years and everything that surrounded it. The memo, all the interviews you guys did, you know, Guccifer 2 and WikiLeaks, the whole thing. But yeah. I have this question that it's just kind of been grating at me when it comes to the dossier.
Uh-huh.
So I sent you a couple articles this morning. You guys were able, and I think this was one of the only subpoenas you had asked for, right? And you said, if I'm wrong here, we'll stop.
It was the first one I asked Devin for, because he thought I was out of my mind asking for congressional subpoenas. Because what I didn't realize as a prosecutor, we just whip them out and go get our stuff. But in Congress, the House Intelligence Committee, before I arrived to HPSI, they had issued one subpoena in their history.
Wow.
And when I was when I had left, we had issued 17.
17. And a lot of criminal referrals too, right?
Yeah, a lot. A lot.
and they went obviously really nowhere, except we've got Durham coming out, but hopefully. Yeah. But you guys took Fusion GPS to court.
We had to.
Because they refused to give you their bank records.
Mm-hmm.
But in the transcript of all that, they were saying, we're just going to give you what we paid Christopher Steele because that's what you're looking for. But you guys were looking for much more than that. Was there an attempt to see if Fusion GPS was being paid as a contractor by the FBI?
So here's what I can tell you. This is what happened. So when I asked Devin for the subpoena, I said, hey, look, prosecution 101, follow the money. We had a source that told us the bank was providing the money for Fusion. I said, let's go get that subpoena. It took a long time, but we got it. As soon as we got it and as soon as they challenged it, took us to court, I knew we had hit jackpot.
Yep.
But we weren't able to see the records yet. So what we worked out in federal court was that I told the federal judge through our counsel, I said, hey, let me and one of my colleagues come see all of Fusion GPS's records and then let us decide what's relevant to our investigation. The federal judge issued a federal court order, which is still in play today, which allowed me to do that. So me and my colleague were the only ones on planet Earth to ever look at all those records. I could never even tell Devin about them or the committee. What I was able to do was shake loose portions of those records that were relevant to the HPSI investigation. Now, I did see everything else that Fusion was being paid and paid to do, all the other companies and all the other firms, but there's just stuff that I can't talk about, not because it's classified, it's not, but because there's a federal judge in Washington who'll probably have my head if I do.
Damn it. What do we have to do to get that thing to end?
I don't know.
you could petition the court to remove that order. Anyone can.
But you could literally now today go and look at their bank records right now today as we stand?
No. I had the opportunity back when I was on House Intel. They basically I went into their counsel's office with their bank and they opened the books, basically, so to speak. And we spent the day looking at them.
So they screwed up Michael Cohen, right?
Yeah.
They screwed up Michael Cohen. They said Michael Cohen was in Prague. And Michael Cohen wasn't in Prague, at least not that Michael Cohen, the lawyer for President Trump. However, there was a lot of speculation by like intrepid investigators who had just open source information to go on that they were looking using 702 queries to find Michael Cohen, who had been to Prague to backfill the dossier and be able to say Michael Cohen went to Prague. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but it was so contrived. I was like, Michael Cohen to Prague, this is one of the things that when I first read the dossier, I was like, Devin, let's attack three lines of effort here that are very easy to prove or disprove the credibility of the dossier. One, the salacious, you know, hotel room nonsense that Christopher Steele created. I said, hey, let's just do some basic research. So that hotel room doesn't exist with that penthouse suite in that city in Russia. So I was like, this is totally made up. Then I was like, hey, Michael Cohen in Prague. This is super easy. Let's just go get the toll records for the airlines and see if he was there. It's not classified state secret stuff. He was never there. So I don't know what this, you know, what they were doing with all this 702 nonsense. I was just like categorically false that he was in Prague. And you would think someone of Christopher Steele's caliber, who was an MI6 case officer spy, would be able to figure that out. And that's when I knew the whole dossier was total BS. I was like, if this guy is going through these lengths to make this stuff up, then none of the stuff that actually matters is true.
So you see that and you think that immediately. And I don't think that anybody needs to be a seasoned, intelligent, ridiculously, awesomely talented prosecutor or anyone like you to look at the dossier and be like, this is ridiculous. But then we've got John McCain involved in it. We've got, his staff from McCain Institute, David Kramer bringing it over, Russia specialist. We've got all these people, Christopher Steele doing dossier entries in December after the election had already finished. You know, did you look into any of this stuff and how those people were involved with this?
100%. We would find out that guys like McCain staffer, and I forget, former staffer, and I forget that guy's name. We interviewed him during...
David Kramer.
David Kramer, I think is right. Him, it ended up being, and this one was one of the ones that shocked me the most, Paul Ryan, who was then Speaker of the House, his chief of staff got an early copy of the dossier in December of 16, and for some reason didn't inform us during the entire Russiagate investigation. Another guy that got an advanced copy was it Kitzinger, that guy from Illinois or whatever his name is?
Yeah.
The congressman?
Yep.
So we were like, this guy is seeding this dossier before taking it public to friendly audiences. That is, you know, tradecraft 101. Why is he doing that? He wants it to be carried with weight and distributed appropriately so that it lands with the appropriate people, i.e. the McCain Institute guy, i.e. this guy in Congress, Kitzinger, who obviously hates Trump, i.e. the former Speaker of the House's chief of staff, who weren't exactly helpful during our investigation. But we didn't know those things right away. We sort of uncovered them as we went along during the investigation.
What did you feel like when they wouldn't release the memo and they claimed they needed to redact this, like, ridiculously? And then Adam Schiff puts out his memo that is full of just lies. Like, how do you combat that? Like, what are you thinking when you see that come out?
Well, so I can tell you this now. We sort of baited Adam Schiff on that one. We knew they would challenge our memo. But what we put in our memo was we decided intentionally not to put footnotes. We just automatically used direct quotes from either interrogations under oath, or we took direct quotes from documents the FBI and DOJ and the IC produced and wrote a 3-4 pager. We knew they would challenge it, but then we also had the plan the entire time to let him write his own response memo, which we voted out ourselves, because we knew he would put 10 times more classified information in that would be more useful to us in the long run.
Oh. Which it was. Oh. Now that's interesting.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever told anyone that.
That's amazing. So what did you end up using from that idiot? Yeah, right?
Yeah, I mean, so at the time, you got to go back. Our memo was what, 3.5-4 pages?
Yeah.
It was like 16.
Yep.
And basically, we knew they were loading it up with hyperbole. Bruce Orr is a perfect example. They were like, why are they attacking this career DOJ guy who had nothing to do with the dossier? Obviously, that's totally false. And everybody knows now about Nellie Orr, who was on the payroll for Fusion GPS to specifically cultivate information against President Trump and his allies. And we also know that Bruce Orr, through the Orr 302s, was the FBI cutout even after Steele was terminated to feed Steele's information to the FBI to renew FISAs on multiple occasions. So that's just one piece of it. The Fusion GPS funding line is another piece of it. And I haven't looked at that document in some time, but what we were able to get out was so much more information than had we tried to get it out declassified in our own memo. Our memo would have taken 10 times longer. We got out the major highlights that we knew were incontrovertible and actually factually 100% accurate. And then we wanted them to put their misinformation out too, so later the public could see that Adam Schiff was literally full of shit.
I love it. That's freaking fantastic. That's, you know, really, that's awesome.
I think that's the bigger problem for a lot of everybody just on the outside watching all this play out like a really bad soap opera with a lot more impacts on day-to-day American life, is that no matter how much verifiable, documented evidence was produced, and there was always just going to be a fictitious counter response, a memo, or the fictitious rereading of the transcript from Ukraine. And of course, with the backup of the media willing to go and put that on out there even farther and expand on that, everybody's like, well, what do we do? What do we do when there's actual bona fide proof on one end that is at least justified to go ahead and have a really serious investigation? And then on the other side, it's whatever they say from day to day is just the way it is, and that's what we just have to live with. I mean, For you on the inside, that must have been even more frustrating because you're producing all this evidence. But, man, we're all feeling that one.
Yeah, that was it was tough being in there at the time because obviously the only thing the media cared about was anything Adam Schiff and his crew of miscreants, Swalwell and those other morons were saying. But because they just gobbled it up as truth. And when they wrote his memo, they obviously jumped on it and said, look at all the inconsistencies between what Adam Schiff's saying and what we're saying. And if you look at it now, which obviously none of those people in the mainstream media will, because they covered everything that was false. And you guys covered everything that was true. We know now that what we wrote stood the test of time, and ours is the actual truth, and all of theirs is hyperbole to help the Democratic Party.
When the dossier was released by the, I think it was BuzzFeed, I said immediately, when you saw CNN yelling at BuzzFeed because they did this, I knew that the purpose for this dossier was not for it to be released all in one shot, and it was for them to pull from it over the course of a year, 2 years, or whatever, to continuously drop this stuff from this document that this, you know, the spy intelligence officer source had compiled, and they ruined the whole plan, BuzzFeed did, when they dropped it all at once. When did you guys know that there was a FISA on Carter Page?
Pretty early on. We just couldn't talk about it. I think I got to HPSI in like April of 17. And one of the first things I did after I got there was read the FISA. But back then I couldn't say anything. None of us could. There was only a couple of people who knew it back then. And we were getting limited access at the time to it. But since we had our investigation up and running, we were able to slowly force DOJ and the clown show being run there by Rod Rosenstein to start getting us access to what we needed.
When did Carter Page know he had a FISA warrant on him?
Man, I don't know. You'd have to ask him. I think he always suspected it, but I'm not sure what date he knew for sure until it was maybe around the time of, you know, I don't know the timeline. Did we disclose before our memo that there was a FISA on Carter Page? So it was probably around that time when we first made it public, was when he first became aware of it. But you'd have to ask him.
Super interesting. There's so much stuff that went on around this time. Knowing that there's now this FISA warrant on Carter Page, when this all started happening, I actually took the dossier and I did a debate using it against itself, like to contradict itself.
Yeah,
because it did. It throughout the whole dossier, it contradicted itself. So they would say one thing and then a paragraph somewhere else would contradict what they had said originally. And now, you know, they're going after Manafort, and that's primarily, it seemed, what Nelly Orr was focused on, right?
So here's what we did. Since I was a terrorism prosecutor, I did FISAs myself. And I told Devin, I said, look, they're clunky, they're long, but the subject portion of them is pretty short and it's easy to dig into. Let's look at the credibility. And the big thing that I told Devin was, I said, look, one of the big red flags that came up was how much of the Steele dossier was in the FISA. We couldn't tell
word
anyone.
Word for word.
But it was in there. And I was like, you can't have a FISA warrant on this stuff, because we'd already discredited so much of it so easily. I was like, the FBI didn't just get this wrong by mistake. Someone was driving this thing. But I did say to Devin, I said, look, the heart of the matter is you have to prove to the court that so-and-so, and in this case, Carter Page, is an agent of a foreign power. He's doing the bidding of a foreign government. And the one thing in the Steele dossier that said basically that was this meeting Carter Page had with these two Russian guys who are close to Putin. And they basically said, we're going to give you $19 billion with a B if you help us when Trump gets in power. And I told Devin, I said, if that's true, this guy's totally playing for the other guys. But I said, it's so easy to prove. It's a public meeting. Like, did this happen? Was he there? And once we dug in and found out, not only did it not happen, but Carter Page gave the FBI exculpatory evidence about how and the reasons for it not happening, not to mention the fact that the CIA, which we can now say, used Carter Page as a source for good. These things just didn't add up. And I said, there's no way that we could have gotten a FISA on anyone had anyone actually done the underlying due diligence, or there was a ton of malfeasance.
So when you're doing this, then you had to have somehow come across Stefan Halper, correct?
Yeah, a long time ago, but I was not able to talk about it until 2 weeks ago.
Wow, so good. Let's talk about it.
Yes.
First of all, why is that? Why weren't you allowed to talk about it till 2 weeks ago?
Because it, irrespective of what awesome investigative journalism you and our small crew of folks did, the problem for me was that information was still classified. And then 2 weeks ago, there was a it was part of that declassification that President Trump issued on his last day.
The transcripts.
The transcripts regarding Stephon Halper. So I highlighted that as an example of, hey, I knew this 3 years ago and we were working on it and we wanted to get it out, but it was classified, so I couldn't ever talk about it.
So Stephon Halper was paid by the Office of Net Assessment millions of dollars to do worthless papers on things that didn't have any, you know, why are elephants still in the Serengeti? nonsense BS, for lack of a better word. And he was obviously very involved in the General Flynn matter because of Svetlana Lakova and his work with, you know, what he did over there at Cambridge. And then obviously bringing Carter Page over there. I forget his name now. You'll probably remember. There was some guy that came out to try and get out in front of this who was sort of an establishment type that was working to put this conference together over there where Page was flown out to appear. And it was just very... Go ahead.
In London. Yeah, the thing in London.
Yeah. So what role, because Stephon Halper talked to everybody. He talked to Sam Clovis. They kept in touch after. As a matter of fact, Page was talking to Stephon Halper months after the Cook campaign ended. I mean, after President Trump was in office. What do you think that's all about?
Well, so here's the thing, right? Even though that some of that stuff on Stephon Halper was declassified, a lot of it still isn't. And basically, we knew that, which you guys now know, Stephon Halper was used by the government, let's just say the United States government, to go after Trump associates, as you said, Sam Clovis. We knew that a long time ago. He was targeting not just Carter Page for the FBI, but others, because they had said, go and basically bump these guys, create relationships, and let's develop an investigation. Now, the stuff that I hope is in that January 20th declassification for President Trump is all the underlying documents that I really want the public to see regarding what Stephon Halper's work was and the mountain of exculpatory evidence that he had given the FBI and the FBI didn't disclose to the FISA court.
He give it to them or did they gather it because he was wired?
The better way of phrasing that is because he was working for the FBI, he was the one receiving that information from all people. So you're right. You're 100% right. That's the more accurate way to say it.
I just don't want anyone to think he's some good guy that was like, they're innocent.
No, he's not. He's not.
And I mean, he plays a huge role. So you focused mainly on the Trump-Russia kind of connection and disproving that. And we got to read these transcripts way after the fact from, you know, Mark Elias and all these people. And you guys were in there interviewing these people. And, you know, it's the difference between the questions on the Democrat side and the Republican side is just mind-blowing to me.
We're actually conducting an investigation. They were running a soap opera. So basically, you know, we set up, I did every one of these interviews. We set them up. They were brutal, you know, sometimes multi-day long affairs, because all Adam Schiff and company wanted to do was talk about the dossier. And when Fusion GPS was in there, they took investigative tips from Fusion GPS. And I was like, is this really what we're doing? We're the architects of the biggest conspiracy to occur to a presidential campaign and a sitting president. We're going to take the guys who we caught and say, how should we do this more? That's what the Democrats were focused on. We were focused on the three C's: conspiracy, coordination, and collusion, which 70 people under oath answered didn't exist.
Can you tell me what you guys did when Dianne Feinstein leaked the transcript of Glenn Simpson's interviews and said she did it because she had a cold?
Colds make you do weird things.
Well, so remember, that was on the, that was their That was their transcript. I think they also had one on the Senate side. We wanted our transcripts out right after, like, when we issued our report. That was the whole point. And if you remember, we even sent them out on a committee vote for declassification. And the, you know, people running the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, then under Dan Coats, basically shut it down and stopped that process cold. And it wasn't until Rick Grinnell and I got over to run the DNI that we were able to finally complete that process. But that only took in a year and a half.
And there was no lack of controversy when you guys went over to DNI either. Everybody was shaking in their boots when that happened.
Well, they didn't want us to do it because it proved here's one of the most stark examples. We knew for the longest time when we interviewed Andy McCabe about the FISA, because the Steele dossier was so utilized in the FISA application, which is something everybody now knows. We asked Andy McCabe flat out, hey, do you get a FISA warrant approved by the FISC on Carter Page without a Steele dossier? And he said no. And it was in our memo, right? Yep. We put it in our memo and got it declassified. But we couldn't get that transcript declassified for almost 2 years. And everybody came after us, including Andy McCabe's people, saying we were lying about what Andy McCabe said under oath. And I said, great, why don't you just release it? It's right here in black and white. And we couldn't get it out for the longest time. But by the time we did, you know, no one really cared anymore. It didn't matter that we were the ones telling the truth. And the deputy director of the FBI admitted that there would be no FISA without the Steele dossier, which basically gutted their entire investigation.
It did matter. It mattered to a lot of us.
Yeah. No, you know, real Americans.
Yes. And, you know, that brings me to what you guys did there in the case of General Flynn. How does Prosecutor Jensen work with you guys, or U.S. Attorney Jensen, I should say, work with you guys there to get the stuff about General Flynn and the logs of the unmaskings and all of that declassified? Did he come to you and ask you for that, or how did that work?
No, so we never focused on Flynn or Manafort when I was working with Devin on House Intel. We focused on the Russiagate stuff. Yep. When I left House Intel and went, and then I left House Intel, went to the White House and didn't really work on this stuff for a while. The next time any of this information sort of crossed my path was when I was the deputy at DNI and Rick was the acting DNI. And so we assisted in the declassification of some of these matters that, say, a Jensen needed for Flynn or whatever, and the FBI, they would come to us as the head of the IC and say, we need some of this stuff declassified. And of course we said, no problem. There's no detriment to national security, and there's no sources that's gonna get jeopardized because of it. Now we still have to fight the internal machine at the FBI and DOJ that didn't want this out, but we were able to finally get it out. But they were the ones that released it. And I think you gotta give credit to the US attorney at the time from DC and to Jensen for comboing up on the Flynn stuff. That was mostly their effort.
I want to ask you that question then, because that makes one believe that there were really good people in there trying their darndest.
There were some awesome people. There were some amazing people doing it.
Are they still there, or are they gone now?
No, they're not there anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all of this about General Flynn comes out and ties back into the grander sort of story of what went on, even though you weren't really focusing on that part when you were over there. However, in the Mueller, I don't even want to call it a report. I want to call it like the reader. I don't even know, like fiction, nonsense, propaganda piece. it was horrible. It really was. But he did give us some stuff in there. Like Konstantin Klimenek was actually an FBI source. And now the FBI's got a wanted poster out on him for $250,000 or whatever it is. And it also told us a lot about WikiLeaks and what they were trying to say about WikiLeaks, and the fact that there was no evidence at that point that Russia had done anything to the DNC servers. Did you get very much involved with that at all, the WikiLeaks angle of this and the DNC and all that?
Yeah, I mean, we interviewed CrowdStrike and their CEO and one of the British guys overseas, I can't remember his name. We went down a lot of those paths because we wanted to get to the bottom of the DNC server issue, which was part of our investigation. And what we were able to determine was the FBI under James Comey allowed a third-party private client to determine what the United States government could and couldn't look at, which was outrageous. But the guy that ran CrowdStrike was a former FBI agent, so it didn't surprise me at the end of the day. Now, if you look at our interviews, that guy, Henry, whatever
Sean
his
Henry.
Name was, yeah, admitted that they didn't have any information about the details of the WikiLeaks hack and the DNC server.
But that was later. That was a couple of years later, right?
No,
but it didn't get out till a couple of years, right?
No, it didn't get out until a couple of years. Because I remember that that came out around the time of Ukraine that we realized that they started doubling, backing off on their claims that they actually had anything.
The interview was done in December of 2017, I want to say, or?
Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what, he was one of the guys we interviewed.
Yeah.
That's why the transcript's out. But of course, they were continuing, the mainstream media was continuing the chorus of, you know, the DNC server hack has to be connected to the Russians who have to be connected to Trump, and they all did it together. And the one company that the DNC hired to do their internal audit didn't have any information to that effect, and their CEO admitted it to us under oath, but we couldn't tell anyone for 2 years.
When that happens, so Perkins Coie, I know you guys interviewed Elias and everything, and the first time, his son, I'm sorry, Podesta's son was Elias's attorney for the first hearing. Say again?
So Mark Elias did not disclose, he was Podesta's attorney when we interviewed Podesta. And Mark Elias didn't disclose that to us. And we found out later and we were like, WTF, what are you guys doing? So we interviewed him and Sussman, who are the two DNC lawyers at Perkins Coie, and, you know, found out a lot of interesting information, which now you guys have seen.
So I could swear that Elias had Podesta's son as his counsel.
Oh, when Mark came in?
Yes.
Yeah, might be true. I don't remember off the top of my head. It's in the deposition transcript. Like, it'd be right up front. I can't recall.
Yeah, the first day. And then he realized you guys meant business. And he was like, I can't have this. And he changed his mind and had someone else come in the next day for the next round of testimony, which I found super, super interesting. But
they had a high-profile lawyer come in. Kathy Rumler, former White House counsel under Obama, was the lawyer that I remember for the Perkins Coie guys.
That was the second day Elias testified or talked to you guys. That was who it was, Rumler, who was linked throughout this entire story more than one would wish to even think about as a fixer. And she was on the special counsel, no?
No. She was not on the special counsel. She was a DOJ, former DOJ attorney, she was White House counsel for a brief period of time.
She repped pedophile guy. What's his name? He was charged with pedophilia after the special counsel was done with him.
Nader.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
Well, that's not his first go around.
No. Yeah. No, it's not. Okay. So sorry. I never thought I'd ever get to sit and talk to the person who did this. So I know that.
I'm around. You know how to find me.
And now I do. And I'm going to be like, so back then when things are going to be hitting me all day, I have so many questions. So let's talk about this then. WikiLeaks, the whole thing with them, whistleblowers are coming out of the woodwork. Assange wants to come over here and talk to James Comey about what happened with the information that came to him from the DNC that he used to leak. Comey says no. And Assange is saying, well, if I can come over there, I'll give you information that will help you in the, you know, Vault 7 leaks that are about to come out to limit the damage there. But I want to be able to talk about what happened with this whole Russia nonsense and where I got this information. And James Comey says, no, you can't do that. We don't want to know. Stay over there. Shuts it all down.
The FBI and the DOJ have... You know, Congress has almost no powers when it comes to conducting investigations. That's the thing people need to understand. And having been at FBI and DOJ and Congress, you see the awesome power that you do have when you're in the executive branch. And then when you go over to the legislative branch, when it comes to investigating, you have almost none. So when they get to dictate investigations, and of course, their criminal investigations, and I agree with this, take precedence over congressional oversight investigations, but only if they're done appropriately. But, you know, you can't fight James Comey And once he shut down WikiLeaks and stuff, you know, there was no access for us to get to Julian Assange.
Wow. Because Dana Bonte goes over there. He's talking to Rand Paul. You know, all these congressmen are talking to Assange, trying to apparently get some sort of information. You guys are in a box. You can't do anything.
No, there's just not. We don't have the, you know, we don't have the mechanics, the ability, or the sway to get that type of interview or investigative line of effort going.
So this is a little outside the box, but it's something that I've always wondered, and it's poignant today. There is a supposed whistleblower who says that he came and sat with you guys and gave a whole bunch of information about something that happened with Rod Rosenstein and the whole Seth Rich thing and all of that, but all kinds of other information about how corrupt Rod Rosenstein is. And he says he worked on this task force and then he was targeted. His name was like Ryan Dark White. Did you ever get to meet with that guy? Is that true?
Well, so first of all, with whistleblower stuff, I can't ever talk about that.
Because well, he is.
He or whoever can do whatever he wants. But two, I do not recall ever talking about any of that stuff to any quote unquote whistleblower.
Okay. Well, that's fair. That's good. Because it's, you know, people don't think that anybody that they know or like are in this sphere is going to get to talk to someone like you and ask these questions.
No, it's fine. I mean, I took on Rod Rosenstein myself, but that's a different thing.
Can you tell me about that? Because there were threats made, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, Rod Rosenstein, who was basically the attorney general because Sessions had stepped aside, was the one who we had dealt with the entire time. And he was the one, you know, running the defense, the Department of Justice, who did not know what a Woods file was, who didn't know the basics about FISAs. And, you know, it would be me and Devin Nunes and Trey Gowdy in his office talking to him about document production. And there were so many times where he just flew off the seat and lost his temper. The main time was when he came with Chris Wray and their crew to the House Intel Committee to meet with myself and Devin and our staff director. And we were requesting certain documents and access to certain DOJ and FBI witnesses. And he literally started screaming at me and said, "I'm going to investigate you guys. I'm going to subpoena your records." And we just thought for the attorney, the deputy attorney general, the acting attorney general, to threaten the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee and his staffers with an investigation because we were doing our constitutional oversight obligations was horrendous. And nobody seemed to care at the time, including Paul Ryan's office. And I wrote this all up and I referred it to them. And I said, "Hey, the House Intelligence Committee is a committee of jurisdiction for the Speaker of the House. I think you guys would want to care that the Attorney General just threatened to investigate its chair and its your staffers because they didn't like the questions we were asking because it was leading to further embarrassment for the DOJ." And Paul Ryan and his chief of staff and company just told us to basically go fly a kite. They didn't seem to care either to have our backs, which wasn't surprising. And I have that. If they ever challenge me on that, I have all the emails where they said it. But it was just insane where Rod Rosenstein, who you would think would want to help us get to the bottom of it, didn't. But that's just one example where he flew off the rails. He did it at the Department of Justice at a meeting with me and Devin and Trey and a couple other folks, where he started yelling at Devin for no reason and started yelling at Devin about his constituencies in Southern California who are Armenian, because Rod Rosenstein's wife happens to be Armenian. Like, no one had any idea what this guy was talking about.
You know, that kind of goes along with what McCabe had said about Rosenstein kind of losing it.
Yeah, he has a terrible temper.
Do you think that the 25th Amendment talk was actually legit? Like, in your experience with him, does it sound like something he would offer to do, to wear a wire into the White House?
In my opinion, yeah. In my opinion, in my experience with him, 100%. That guy is the biggest weasel to ever walk the halls of the Department of Justice. And the fact that he led it is an embarrassment to the people who work there.
Yeah.
So did he, when he decided to bring on Mueller, he was under the impression he would be fired, as per what kind of like the rumor mill has said about all of that. Was he like a weasel and a coward and stupid and scared? Like, did they have something on him? What's the deal with him? Like,
I don't know if they have anything on him, but your descriptive words are on point. I don't know if the Mueller guys had, I don't know what they would have on him. Maybe they had more information about that whole 25th Amendment episode. Not sure the back and forth that happened between Mueller and Rosenstein, who Mueller was reporting to. So, you know, I never got any insight on that, but
Did you think that Jeff Sessions should have recused himself?
No.
Interesting. Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah. Landmines. Landmines and booby traps everywhere.
Yeah.
I feel like we're rapid fire questions.
That's the whole thing. And your question earlier, Tracy, about how many people are left behind and there's nobody there, it really makes you wonder. I mean, we've seen so many operations around the country. I think of someone like Ruby Freeman out in Georgia. And I think if this is the kind of thing that's going on the ground level, I mean, and people are all right with this kind of an operation, obviously it's going to be all right with wheeling and dealing and bending the rules and on larger levels, places where cash was. And and now with everybody gone and having a little bit of a run-in, a brush with death that Donald Trump could have been. Everybody worried for 4 years, all hands on deck. How do we survive this 4 years? I can't imagine that over the course of the next few years, there's not going to be so many safeguards put in place so that if there is ever an organic American president that's elected again, they will never have the problems that they thought they may have with Donald Trump. Cash, let me ask you this. If Trump were inaugurated and he had a new set of 4 years, what do you think his trajectory, what do you think his, do you had any insight, I should say, as to what his game plan would have been? And do you think that this group that you were really trying to bring to account would have ever been able to outlast another 4 years of prodding and investigating?
Well, that's just it. The whole purpose of doing any of the work we did was accountability. It's what led me to leave the Department of Justice, because how can you ask people who are charged with enforcing the laws of our country and putting others behind bars to exert accountability of the American public, but not have the accountability exerted over themselves for when they screw up? And so that was the major focus of the investigation. And I think we achieved, you know, we achieved in a large part from Congress's perspective, because if you look at it, we got 14 people from DOJ and FBI fired or retired early. That's almost impossible to do. If you know anything about federal government regulations, you can't fire anyone. But to get these people to leave, the only way you could do it is by embarrassing them, that their conduct was so outrageous that they have to leave. The Peter Strzoks, the Lisa Pages, the Andy McCabes, the Comeys, and all their other, you know, their crew that was with them. And it wasn't a lot of people, but it was the people at the top.
Walt Rybicki, Priestap.
Priestap, that were exerting so much power, and they all decided to, some of them actually got fired, and rightfully so. I mean, the deputy director of the FBI leaked to the media and then lied about leaking. I mean, how can you have a law enforcement agency that's supposed to be the best in the world led by this type of person? And so there was some measure of like public accountability, but to the level of, you know, whatever Durham's doing and whatnot, that's the ultimate trigger that people care about. And don't know where that's going to go. Had we won another 4 years, was I discussing how to shape it better and how much personnel matters? Absolutely. And we had a pretty good map of how that would go in the next 4 years. And, you know, maybe we'll get the next 4 years in 24.
Yeah. And do you think that Bill Barr was the right guy for this job, like, in your opinion, or?
I think he had his moments. It was a tough job. I think he ended up doing a lot of good for the department. But I think he basically ended up being a one-man shop with some great senior staffers helping me that just couldn't tackle everything coming their way, and ended up folding. And that's unfortunate. We needed someone to to break through that logjam, and I don't know that he did.
Do you think there was anything else that President Trump could have done?
Yeah, I mean, declassify more material. I mean, him directly?
Yeah.
You know, probably maybe make some other personnel moves, 100%. I don't believe that there was the right people at the various agencies who were serving his best interests. So, you know, maybe he could have made some different personnel decisions, but that's like Monday morning quarterbacking. And it's hard to replace a number of people after you've lost a reelection campaign.
One more thing, circling back like Jen Psaki does. when, you know, when we talk about the Russian interference, I know everybody says Russia always interferes in our elections, blah, 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 blah. Great, great, great. But do you think that they had anywhere near the impact that even some on the, you know, quote unquote truth side of things have made it out that they had on the 2016 election?
Do I think they
really impacted the election that much at all, even with their meddling, which is a word that I absolutely hate now? But even with that, did they impact anything at all? Was it that serious?
In terms of the actual outcome and vote count in 2016? No. In terms of, are we still talking about it today? And is Putin sitting out there having a scotch in wherever, Siberia? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but I don't think that was even his intention. I think we handed them a gift they never could have even hoped for.
Oh, yeah. The fact that this is still going on is one of the, for that, from the Russian perspective, probably a win. But in terms of, we actually looked into the amount of money the Russian government had expensed on social media sites and at the polls to actually change votes. And I think if you go back and look at a report, and we'll rely on that, but we couldn't find any evidence that it actually changed the outcome of votes on Election Day.
The left, and like Dianne Feinstein, after your memo was released, wrote a letter to Twitter. Well, before it was released, actually, because we had all done this Twitter campaign and changed our names to release the memo. And
yeah, I remember that.
That was actually me that did that.
That was awesome. And then I wrote a song about it. I remember that, too.
Release the memo. Yeah. And I did, you know, we started this hashtag campaign, and Dianne Feinstein wrote to Twitter saying that Russian bots were behind a campaign on Twitter for you guys to release the memo, and that they should squelch the hashtag and stop letting it trend. And that, I think, was just the beginning of this sort of censorship push. I mean, you know, you've been in so many different areas in government at this point now. Is there any hope for us with the way things stand today? Or are we just like, you know, like are the Vindmans of the world just going to take over and leave us kind of like flailing in the wind out here?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know that President Biden is going to care about any of these issues, or his administration is going to exert the necessary amount of energy to get this information to the American public. The only way to do it, if they don't, is to have a large public outcry to force government and Congress to react. And as you know, that's very difficult to do. Huh. So the only other way to do it is to win back the House in 22 and the Senate, and then have our guys on the Hill hammer that for the next election cycle, and then take back the White House in 2024.
I just won precinct committeeman yesterday for the Republican Party.
Oh, well. Here we go. Here we go. The so, next chapter begins.
Watch out.
Yeah.
Coming for you. Watch out. Frank, any questions? I'm going to have so many more after this is over. Like, I'm going to be dinging you with random thoughts. But Frank, you have anything left before?
No. I've asked everything that came to mind over the course of the interview. And you, of course, you were so thorough that you took several thoughts out of my head. So it's all good. And it's just wonderful to have Cash in the fold now.
Yeah, I'm around. It was great chatting with you guys. I had fun.
Yeah, yep. This is like the laid back version of Nancy Drew meets, like, I don't know. It's funny. Can I tell this story? We can cut it out after if you don't want me to say this. But yesterday he texted me and said, it's audio only, right? And I said, yeah, you can do a stelter if you want.
I did not, but it was hilarious. I thought.
to think that he thought that that was going to humanize him in any way, to show him sitting there curling up without his pants on. Oh, man.
Yeah, well, talk about someone who has zero credibility in the media.
Oh, yeah.
All horrible. Oh, Cash, yeah. you are very humble and kind to meeting you at CPAC was wonderful. You were pretty much like this guy who doesn't think that anybody knows that who you are and what you've done. But I got to tell you, honestly, you are regarded so highly by so many people out there who really care about this country as someone who kept fighting and didn't give up and really did some amazing things for us. And it wasn't for naught. You have pretty much helped to awaken a good percentage of the country to what our government was doing. And I just want you to know that. So please understand that you're very important to us.
No, it means the world to me to hear you guys say that. But our work is done in tandem. So without folks like you, you guys, I mean, it doesn't go anywhere. So I hope you guys keep hammering. And it means the world to the me and Devin and the John Ratcliffes and all the other guys that we sort of waged a campaign with. So I hope you guys keep going.
Well, thanks so much. And I'm not stopping anytime soon. So
great.
Thanks, Cash.
We'll see you soon.
And there it was.
And there it went.
That was great. I mean, really, really great. I started scribbling notes, Frank. Because I had so many things that I had a list of questions that I like wanted to ask, and I never make a list of questions. But this is Cash Patel.
Hey, and if we can have him on every 3 or 4 weeks, that would be great. Have a little hello, a little taking of the temperature.
Yeah, and especially because he's a fellow Long Islander, you know?
Yeah, well, you guys got to stick together.
We sure do. Frequenting the same establishments was good. Very good. So that was it for this week. We will come back on Monday with I have a lot of stuff lined up from Monday's show already, Frank. So if you guys are not in the Telegram room, you're really missing out. So, Frank, you should join up in that room.
I'm in the room. I hardly have time to even drop things into my own. I just try so hard, Tracy. There's so many things.
I'm just going to keep busting your chops on it. It's not going to stop.
So many things to be on.
I put a funny video in there this morning. You should go watch it.
Okay.
And you've been listening to the Dark Delay Podcast with...
Thank God it's Friday, Frank. And...
Beans. You can hear us every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 2:30 Eastern Time on TuneIn, Stitcher, Apple iTunes, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and RadioInfluence.com. We will talk to you again on Monday.
See you later.